This episode of Current Geek is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, your customers get every way to pay. To learn more and try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/currentgeek.
I have
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, Geeks of the World, and you. To keep you current on all things that matter most, I'm Scott Johnson. That's Tom Merritt.
I am Tom Merritt, and I am here, Scott.
Yay.
I have been here since last Friday, waiting.
Yeah, the internet took a poo where I live, and we didn't have a show last week. So the last time there was technically a Current Geek, and we had something for people to listen to, was our, I think, pretty triumphant Nerdtacular episode. It's pretty good.
It was.
Yeah.
I considered it a triumph. I marched through the center of Los Angeles with lions.
Whoa, that's great. Mm-hmm. I thought that was disallowed many years ago.
Stole that joke from somebody else earlier today.
Because of the drought. Are you drinking all the water?
Anyway. No, I couldn't start my weekend last week. We didn't have Current Geek.
Yeah, how'd you do? Did you make it?
And it wasn't my fault.
Yeah.
You know, unlike next week when we don't have Current Geek, which is my fault for traveling. But our guests today were around, and we did do a text adventure, Current Geek.
Oh, my gosh. I can't wait to hear more about this. Joining us today, as they would have last week, but instead for real now, let's start with Jocelyn Moffat from The Angry Chicken, among other projects. Jocelyn, welcome back to the third, technically fourth appearance on the show.
Yeah, the text adventure completely counts. So this is my fourth time here.
Yeah, I guess so. So wait, before we introduce our second guest, just tell me quickly, how did the text adventure work? Like, was it like a text adventure where you would say, go north, and then it would respond and say, you've gone north and you found a stick? Like, how did it go?
Well, okay, maybe not so adventure-y, more role-play-y.
Mm. Yeah, we are Pete. We are Pete.
Yeah, we totally are Pete.
That's amazing.
Tom was you, and chat room was Tom, and then, well, I played myself, which wasn't much of a stretch. And
yeah,
you did a really good job.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. You'll get a Current Geek Award at the end of all this, so stay tuned for that. Also with us, from the Gamers Inn, among other projects, Ryan Murphy.
Hello.
How you doing,
thank
man?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great having you on. You two actually do that show together. You hang out and do stuff, which is nice. But you also do a bunch of other things. And by the way, there's your pop quiz, which is coming up later, digs into one of your other areas of expertise. And so I just want that to be your hint. That's all there is.
Oh, no. I bet I know what yours is.
Mm.
I'm only good at video games.
Oh, no. Well, then you're in huge trouble because that is definitely not that. Well, we'll see. Oh, we'll see how you do. I'm sure it'll all be fine. Well, we're happy to be here. It's Current Geek. We're back. And it's time for the headlines.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Thomas?
We get our stories from you, people. If you don't go to currentgeek.reddit.com, we have nothing to talk about, and the show's over. So thank you to everybody who goes in there, submits stories, votes. Nethken wants us to talk about Google renaming itself Alphabet, and then merging with itself and becoming a holding company of independent corporations, one of which is Google.
One more step to world domination. Jocelyn, are you worried about the fact that you can spell Skynet with letters from the alphabet?
No.
No, okay. Maybe I've gone too far.
Does any of this make sense?
Yeah, does any of this make sense? How do you feel about your favorite search engine branching out in this kind of way?
I am so confused about what they're even doing. Like, Google's becoming Alphabet, but now they're smaller but bigger, and
it's very simple. Very simple. Google creates a holding company called Alphabet within itself. It then merges with that company and then absorbs all the Google stock into Alphabet, but the Alphabet stock still trades under the name Goog. But Google is then spun back out as a subsidiary that is separate from other companies like Nest, etc.
Okay.
Right?
Imagine why I found that confusing.
Why is that
all
so hard?
It's like the Bitcoin.
The real honest to goodness simple explanation is Alphabet becomes the corporation that owns sub corporations. And instead of Nest being part of Google and that being messy because one makes thermostats and the other makes search engines, Google is its own company under Alphabet. Nest is its own company. X Labs is its own company. Life Sciences, etc., etc.
Right. So they made an umbrella.
Yeah.
An umbrella corporation. That name sounds familiar.
Uh-oh.
The Umbrella Corporation. Nothing to do with zombie dogs jumping out of windows or anything. It's fine.
Nope.
Don't get freaked out. Ryan, what do you think about this big merger?
Long as Alphabet doesn't start to be used as a verb, I think we're good. Mm. But I think that it's confusing, but makes sense at the same time. So maybe we'll just let Google do what they want to do.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And we've been talking, so all the talk this week on DTNS and so on, I've come to the conclusion, and Tom, you can tell me if you still think this is true or if it's true at all in the first place, that this just seems like a way for Google to stay, Google/Alphabet/Nest/ all the things that need to have their own CEOs, their own structure. It's a way for them to stay agile in the markets they focus on and not get all jumbled up in one giant company that's starting to lose focus because there's so many things happening under its roof. Is that a fair thing?
That's what Larry Page wants you to think. Mm. And that may be exactly it, is we need to focus these different subsidiaries. A lot of other people have pointed out that this makes it easier to shut an operation down if it's not doing some well, or spin it out if it's doing very well and turn it into its own company. It makes it easier to point to Google and say, Google search is doing better than you think, investors, even though we're spending money on balloons and drone internet. We are still making a lot of money on Google. Right now, that gets obfuscated by the money they spend on these other companies. So they can break that out easier, which they could have done anyway. But this, again, it just makes it cleaner. And we had a great email from a guy who's in the financial industry on DTNS today pointing out that it gives them some legal protection. So if one subsidiary gets sued, it doesn't affect the other subsidiaries. So there's a lot of advantages to it. And it allows, I mean, honestly, what I think it, you know, just my outside the beltway look at it, even though my wife works at YouTube, which is owned by Google, is that they get to play in their sandbox now. Larry and Sergey don't want to run Google anymore. Yeah. They don't want to run the search engine. That's Sundar Pichai's job, and he's great at it. They want to go figure out other cool stuff to do, like X Labs, like life sciences, and they want to work with cool companies like Tony Fadell's Nest. And this gives them a better justification and ability to do it.
Well, can I just say my admiration for your skill at what you do goes up every time you remember, whenever this conversation happens about Google at all, Tom always makes sure to remind everybody his wife works at Google. It's this disclaimer that comes
out
every time.
Did I mention that?
Yeah. I love that. It's amazing. You're like, the talk about journalism has found its footing once again, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, good luck, Google.
Hey, Star Fury Zeta sent us the news that Bill Murray will appear in the rebooted Ghostbusters movie. Rumor has it he will not reprise his role as Dr. Venkman, but will instead play Martin Heiss, a newly created character in this new rebooted universe. The character allegedly may be a professional debunker. That's according to Birth Movies Death. And they say he's going to show up and prove the new Ghostbusters are fake, or at least try to. Heiss is said to be a tiny role that's sort of a mirror image of where Peter Venkman at the start of Ghostbusters was.
So is anyone disappointed that he's not coming back as Venkman here? Not that I
completely.
Are you? Tell me why. Give us a good argument.
It's so sad. I mean, he's so well known for this character. They're bringing him back. You see, oh my God, Bill Murray's going to be in Ghostbusters. Not Venkman. Like he was such a great character, probably my favorite character. Mm-hmm. And then, so I know it's a complete and utter reboot, but I would have just loved him to be some sort of like old mentor-y kind of a character. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I like the idea of him being still sort of cranky, because he was always a little bit cranky. He was the one that didn't really want to be there. He'd rather be, you know, flirting with Sigourney Weaver or whatever. It was always Ray and Egon that were mostly into the happening.
Fighting, yeah.
Sure, all that stuff was their area, and he was more just kind of being a dork. And then later, you know, unwilling hero, but became one anyway. I think it'd be great if he was sort of aging. He was out of it. He was sick of it, and they came to him for advice because they're in a pinch, and he's not really in the mood to give any. It still gives him a small role. It still lets us live through the eyes of Venkman. But I guess if you're going to commit to a reboot, Ryan, you got to stick to the reboot, right?
Yeah, I mean, what if this gives them an opportunity to bring Bill Murray back as an actor into the franchise as this new character? Like, if he really enjoys being in the world again, and it's like, all right, for the sequel to this Ghostbusters, maybe we have the skeptic on the team now, and Bill Murray gets to be that mentor and gets to be killed off like he wanted to be in Ghostbusters 3 or 4 or whatever they were trying to do.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's better than nothing.
Mm.
I can totally see him saying, I'll do it, but I won't be Venkman, and you have to kill me.
Yeah.
I can see that.
It's I don't know, man. I just feel like, remember when he was Bosley in the Charlie's Angels movies, or at least the first one, and then hated it and didn't come back for the second one. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be that kind of thing, just like a little weaselly thing. And maybe it's iconic and it'll be memorable the way it was in Zombieland. But I don't know. I don't know at this stage. And if you don't bring Dan Aykroyd back to do something, then I think you're also missing another opportunity. Even if he's a whole different character and nothing, you know, nothing like Ray or whatever, you gotta bring Aykroyd back for just a second. Even if he's just,
here's the thing. We don't even really know what Bill Murray is going to be doing here.
Yeah.
We do know that we have a better source saying he's in the movie than we have saying what he is in the movie. That's pure
spoiler. What if he yells, what if he just runs past the screen with no shirt on and yells, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria, and that's all we get?
What if he's the guy from Stripes?
Oh my gosh, you're blowing my mind.
Connected right. Universes.
Captain Kipper and T-Glass 1976 both sent us the news that Sesame Street will bring its episodes to HBO 9 months before they air on PBS, where they still will air, as part of a 5-year deal. We also will get 35 episodes a year of Sesame Street instead of the usual 18.
So it's not the it's not that unusual to see this arrangement, I think, because you have to remember it was both Canadian. Oh, by the way, we have Canadians in the room. But we had both the Canadian.
What do you have up there? Do you have Sesame Street or do you have like Sesame Strada or something French?
Polka dot door.
Rue de Sesame. Yeah,
Poutine Street is what they call it up there.
Yeah.
But when you guys got Fraggle Rock up there first, along with HBO, long before it showed up for a lot of other, you know, it was distributed through a lot of channels. But HBO had Fraggle Rock for a long time. And I feel like HBO, around that time when that ended, decided to go all in on everything we make is super adult and it's going to have tons of swearing and naked people everywhere. That's just the rule here at HBO. Now they're saying, bring on back the kids content and programming. We'll show the boobies
at
night.
Or are we going to see a raw Sesame Street?
Oh yeah, Sesame Street's going dark.
Oh man. I don't know. I actually kind of think this is a good thing and I'm interested as a HBO Now user. Now or Go? Yeah, Now. Now. Go. Yeah.
Oh.
I don't use Go. I use Now. I always forget. I get it mixed up. But anyway, we really like it. We've been very happy with it. But I don't know. Something has peaked. I'm very curious. Although, isn't basically Sesame Street just the Elmo show now? I don't know. I don't think it's like what we grew up with, Tom. It's changed.
No, we didn't have Elmo when I was there.
Yeah, even these two young chuckleheads from Canada. What'd you guys get? What'd you watch when you were a kid?
Oh, I had Elmo.
Oh, damn. Yes, he's been around for a while.
Super Grover. Yeah. Super Grover was always my favorite.
Grover's great.
A giant elephant guy.
Does anyone remember the pie guy that would go 12 chocolate cakes and then fall down the stairs? Does anyone remember that?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. See, Tom, that's how I learned 11 and 12.
Tom and I come from the proper generation of Sesame Street viewers.
Abierto.
And the typewriter that would go noo 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 and then do terrible typos on himself. He was fantastic.
Ours was in French, I think. Wasn't it, Ryan? Is that why I'm not?
Maybe.
I was like, I recognize the tune of the song that Tom is singing, but I don't recognize the words at all. It's probably because I think ours is French.
I don't know. I didn't watch a lot of Sesame Street as a kid. Like, I grew up not on cable, so we were watching whatever we could find, which was TVO out of Toronto, which didn't play Sesame Street, just played like the Canadian kids broadcasting stuff, which was like a poor man's Muppet show. Like,
did you get Bananas in Pajamas?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I could sing the song, but of course, you know, we can't pay for that right now.
Aren't so you guys required to go from that to Degrassi Junior High right after that? That's the next watch?
Well, that's the school I went to as a kid. Everybody
everyone goes there.
Everyone went to Degrassi.
Yeah. I knew Drake as a kid. He was a great guy. Yeah.
Drake, really? From Drake and Josh?
Well, I don't know.
Oh, you mean Drake the rapper.
He was on Degrassi.
Mr. Dress Up.
I didn't know he was on Degrassi. Oh, now I do know because there's a famous thing where he gets shot.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh. Yeah. I didn't know he was Canadian. Is he Canadian?
He is Canadian.
Oh, weird.
Hey so I know we're doing a great memory lane bit, which is I am loath to interrupt, But there are still people out there who are falling over because they're like, wait, kids programming on HBO, kids programming that is available on public broadcasting for anyone of any means to access freely over the air, now on a pay service. Does that bother anybody?
Well, what's the advance? It's 9 months in advance?
Yeah, 9 months in advance. See, so PBS gets everything, and they actually get more episodes because of this, and they get a more secure form of funding than the federal government. It's not like they're not getting federal government money, but they'll be adding this HBO deal to it. It's not PBS that's getting the money either. It's the Sesame Workshop that's getting it.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I don't know.
I mean, they're doubling the episodes. They're going to get the content. Kids don't care if it's 9 months old or not. And they're going to keep the content running on PBS. They said they're going to kind of remix some of their old episodes. And so it's not like they're actually losing out on any PBS content. It's just going to be released a little bit later. And I think keeping Sesame Street going, doing 35 episodes instead of 18 is so much more important than everyone able to access the content right away.
I kind of agree.
Because the alternative here, when they were like all the earnings and stuff were in the New York Times article, like they're losing a lot of money. It seems like the alternative here is to either cut episodes even more or get rid of Sesame Street altogether and just play reruns. I think I would rather have new content.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has the stomach to shut them down. So I totally agree with that. And wherever they get the money, whatever partnership they need to do, I think is all a good thing. And Sesame Street does like actually important work. Like it's not just a big goofy party of Muppets. It's actually does some real work and, you know, is famous for this for years and there's studies and all this other stuff. However, it's just weird bedfellows. Like it's strange that HBO is the one because HBO, it's not like HBO's got a huge part of its market going, all right, look, we're really into all the nudity. Could you please get some kids programming? I mean, no, I don't think there's even a demand. So I don't know who's.
I don't know, man. My thought was Netflix is broadening out it to everything. And if HBO Now is moving towards becoming that internet friendly service that HBO Now provides, that's one of the things they got to start doing is branching out and not saying, oh, we're the pay cable channel where the adults watch, but saying we're a channel that anybody can subscribe to and they'll find something they want.
Do you hope, though, that there's a taper? Because on the televised version of this, it's all just running, right? It's not like, you know, HBO's apps where you can decide what you want to watch when you want. That's easy for parents to control that. But when it's HBO just going and let's say it's in the morning and afternoon, they play a bunch of Sesame Street. Do they need a taper or a transition period where, all right, now we'll play Goonies and then maybe we'll get a little harder and do Gremlins.
That's a good point. I think they will pick appropriate follow-up movies to ease you in. They're not going to go straight into Sex
Boobies.
In the City.
Right. Sesame Street. They can't go. Thanks for watching Sesame Street. Up next, the fourth season of Rome. I mean, they can't
We're just doing it in alphabetical order. Sesame Street, Sex in the City, strippers.
Yeah.
The movie.
We'll see how it goes.
Subredditor Swaying let us know, you'll get that in a second, that astronauts aboard the International Space Station ate some romaine lettuce. Team dad joke. Earlier this week, the first time anyone has eaten food grown in space. This is a big deal. Lettuce was grown using rooting pillows containing seeds, which are activated, watered, and cared for by the astronauts. Astronaut Scott Kelly noted that even though it was romaine, he thought it tasted a lot like arugula.
Oh, interesting. So this is kind of a big deal because one of the problems, this is stuff you never think about with space exploration. We all just think we're going to go from square A to square Z, which is, you know, the Picard and his replicator and perfectly good, gravity and all the things that we need here on Earth for the kinds of creatures we are. They'll just suddenly be a part of our space travel. But all of this stuff's got to be figured out and how to grow things and make things and, you know, maybe even one day raising livestock in low gravity situations on a moon base or something like that. Like all of these things have to be tested out and proven. And I think this is awesome. I mean, imagine eating lettuce grown in space. I would do that in a heartbeat. Space lettuce. Wouldn't you guys? Ryan, come on, man. A whole sandwich covered in space lettuce.
In terms of a scientific leap, it's really cool because one of the biggest issues about going to space is weight, right? So if you're not bringing up materials from Earth to the space station, then you're able to carry more fuel or more people or other scientific doodads. But Sorry, I lost my technical term there. But I think really what would be neat is to see, like, are they going to open like a health food store on Earth where it's like all of our stuff is grown in zero G and then you can pay three times as much?
Yeah, it can be gluten free and
gravity free.
Gravity free. There you go.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then they'll say the gravity food with gravity and it's terrible for you, Jocelyn. Don't eat gravity food.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Causes cancer.
Yeah, it's bad every time. Anyway, Tom, you'd eat it, right? You'd eat lettuce and
spice. Oh, hell yeah, I would eat it. I would pay money, good money, to try space lettuce just to see what it's like. I freaking like that Neapolitan ice cream that they still sell from the 60s era of space food. So, I'm eating some lettuce.
Let me think if I'm shocked at all that Tom will go ahead and eat a thing without
thinking too much
about it. Oh, yeah.
I like that vinegar. That was good.
Yeah.
Hey, Adobe and Pagefair issued a report estimating ad blocking will cost $22 billion in lost advertising revenue this year. That's based on the estimated amount of ad blocking they think will happen. Nethken pointed out Marco Armit's post, which is a more well-reasoned and eloquent version of the following. Publishers hadn't forced so many crappy ads down our throat, we wouldn't be blocking them.
True. Don't you think the desire to still block them would, they'd still exist? You know, and there'd be browsers like Chrome and Firefox and things where you could facilitate that blocking. And I think that just some people just do it out of principle. There are people who...
Well, Marco's point of the rise of it is that we used to have pop-ups and then we got pop-up blockers because pop-ups were annoying.
Yeah.
And people have created so many annoying advertisements out there. They get in front of what you're doing. The pop-up blockers don't catch or do whole takeovers and cause the page to get slow. That they've made it a bad experience to read pages with ads. And so this is not an unethical thing. It is a natural reaction of the populace to say, I want to make better use of this information. And you're making it harder by putting weighty, broken, and interfering ads
there. Yeah. And also this idea that we're blocking $22 billion of lost advertising revenue, that doesn't make sense to me. I understand that they didn't see the ads, and I understand people are paying for views of those ads, and not necessarily people responding to the ads, but those who are blocking it weren't in it anyway. They wanted out.
Right, but
out.
If their blocker was off, the ad would have loaded, and then they would have had to pay for that ad loading.
That's true, but
This is actually a fairly solid number. It might be a little high, but for the most part, if an ad blocker blocks an ad, that's an ad that would have been paid for otherwise, and it's not paid for if it doesn't load.
So I assume we're in the hundreds of millions of dollars for ads that get through then, because so many more get through than get blocked. Has to be, right, then?
Okay. Yeah. This is worldwide.
All right. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they were making
it's
that
It's spread
kind of
out
cash.
Amongst a lot of people, though.
Do you guys, so who here in Canada, because you guys are always so nice and you're saying sorry all the time and all that, do you guys block ads up there?
Okay, well, no. Okay, let me explain. So technically, yes, I do have an ad blocker. The only site that I have other than Facebook, because Facebook is just creepy with how accurate they can get with the ads, and I don't want them to know anything about me.
Right.
But outside of Facebook, the only other site I actually block is Wowhead and Hearthhead. But I... like subscribe to their Patreon. Like I pay them in other ways.
Yeah.
And the only reason that I do that is because when I'm playing Warcraft and I have Wowhead open, they, whatever company they were using, because for a really, really, really long time, I didn't use any kind of ad blocking until like literally probably 6 or 8 months ago. And it's because I would have Wowhead open and all of a sudden, louder than anything else on my system, this like ad for Tide would go off and it was like autoplay. It would scare the crap out of me.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay, that's it. Like no more. But then as soon as I started blocking, then I supported the site in other ways.
Okay. So you're actually on, so you fall into his description of, well, publishers hadn't forced crappy ads down our throat, we wouldn't turn on the ad blockers. You're in that group.
100%.
Yeah. How about you, Ryan?
I don't use an ad blocker. I used to, but I think maybe I switched computers and I've just been so too lazy to set it up again. But there are like sites like Wowhead and Hearthhead and a lot of the Wikia type pages, which are, you know, do depend on that ad money. But they're using these services that serve up ads that are just terrible. Yeah. Like Polygon has a big problem with that, too, where the content is great and then the ads are just have nothing to do with it. But where there are sites out there that actually use advertising really well, I think you know, IGN uses really good advertising. It's always video game related or entertainment related and sort of fits in with the content that's there.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's about creating ads that are better, just having ads that tie into the content better. Because then you're just eyeing everything at the same time as opposed to seeing something that's out of left field. I think that's where they need to go.
Well, I run a blocker when I need to do like YouTube in the morning on the show or something. And it's like, oh, someone just sent us a clip of Donald Trump saying something terrible. I want to hear it real fast. And I can't do that live without a bunch of trouble if I've got to sit through a 15-second or even a 5-second ad. So I use it there while doing shows. But it's funny. Everyone I talk to, they all seem to want to support the places they go. But like Jocelyn said, sometimes they just make that stuff so hard that you feel like you're forced to do something to make it so you can actually function on their site, whether it be pop-ups or autoplays or whatever garbage ads they're playing, or they're not relevant, like you were saying, Ryan. So I don't know, Tom. It just feels like...
I mean, that's the argument Marco Arman is making here is one that I agree with, which is, sure, there is a subset of the internet that feels entitled, and Jimmy the Shovel's making this argument very well in the chat room, feels entitled and says everything should be free, and that's unrealistic. Yeah. And so those are the people that have run ad blockers forever. I believe that is a very small minority, and I think Marco is right that what has happened with the rise of ad blocking, getting to a point where it's actually starting to make an impact on ads, has to do with people like Jocelyn, who are saying, I'm not really against ads, but they've forced me in certain situations to change my behavior to stop them. And there's just as much entitlement on the publisher's side of the, we should be able to bother you in any way we want because we're giving you this free page of clickbait headlines. And that's just silly. Yeah. This is the way the internet is supposed to work. You try to put your ad in front of me with your JavaScript. I block your JavaScript. You realize that that wasn't a good way to do it. You back off and come with a new way to advertise that doesn't annoy me. And really, when advertising works, advertising shouldn't annoy you, but inform you and make you go, oh, that's a really interesting product. So the internet can do that. It can target you properly and show you things you like. Always the best example is a movie trailer. We voluntarily watch advertising when we're watching movie trailers, right? Mm-hmm. So really, this is about advertisers not quite doing it right and people reacting. Are there bad actors on both sides? Of course. But most of them are just trying to find the right balance, I think.
That's a good way to put it. Once again, nailed it. Done. Move on.
Star Fury Zeta sent us the Vice article about archaeologist Andrew Reinhard, who argues, quote, there's no difference between cultures in either real or virtual environments, and he's putting his archaeology degree where his mouth is, or something. He examines the items and artifacts of gaming worlds like Skyrim and World of Warcraft in an academic way, and he's teaching courses on this. He calls the discipline archaeogaming.
So when he says there's no difference between cultures in either real or virtual environments, I don't know what he means. He means there's no difference.
He means that when we study Grecian urns, yeah, we all think, oh, that's a very academic and legitimate study. When we study elements of Skyrim or Warcraft in the same way to say, okay, what is the culture that made this and what is the story behind it, which is made by people, right? People make video games. That's no different.
Oh, I see. So real cultural studies versus virtual cultural studies, he's saying there's no difference between those two. I mean, obviously there's differences, but he's saying that it's not like one is silly and superfluous and not worth studying and the other one is simply because it's based on something, you know, that's real. What I thought he was saying is that there are no difference in cultures of any kind.
No. That is not what he's saying. He's saying there's no difference in studying. Like, they are all cultures.
Gotcha.
Games are made by people. Urns are made by people. And so we can study these and learn a lot about people and subcultures and what the subcultures in Warcraft are. Jocelyn, I know you were really interested in this article.
Yeah,
I know. I absolutely loved this. Taking like real life academic pursuits and putting them into video games has always been a huge interest of mine. Like, a lot of people probably don't actually know what my like Twitter handle and stuff stands for, but GIS is Geographic Information Systems. So like my whole background is in geography and mapping and all that kind of stuff. And looking at like the way people move and where they congregate and all that kind of stuff in video games has always been really interesting to me. And I think taking anything like this, geography, archaeology, all of it, and putting it into the study of video games and how people interact with their environments and MMOs and, you know, everything that we create, either as the game creator or as people playing the game, it's all so interesting to me. It's like, what would we do if we had like very few restrictions? It's just, it's so creative and it's so cool. And to study that is just the next level of awesome.
So let me ask
you this.
Totally
geeking out right now.
This always jumps in my head when I think about this sort of thing. And that is like, okay, so World of Warcraft is an example of this and many games do this. But when you go into a game like that, you're making some upfront choices that are inherently in the context of the world, kind of racist or a little bit bigoted. And I don't mean it in the, you know, the very real way humans do this to each other, but in a way it's like an experiment in that. It's like, well, I think the trolls look like underdogs. I'm going to be the trolls because I feel like they should fight against, you know, the upper class, the humans over there in Stormwind or whatever. Or you're maybe making a choice of picking an orc for that reason. They may be ugly, but they're the honorable race just trying to survive or whatever. People might pick humans because they're the ones with the better technologies, or they're the ones with the right to be on the land they're on. They didn't get invaded. They invaded us, kind of thing. That's totally interesting to me as a study of why we're able to take, we're not only able to make racial choices in video games, we're encouraged to take sides and wage war against the other factions and races that are not seeing eye to eye with us. And in a weird way, it creates like this experimental playground where we can express some of that human nature without actually being racist toward each other, if that makes sense. Is there some of that in there for you in terms of why it's interesting and fascinating? Because it always interests me.
Oh, 100%. Like, you can pretty much study anything in a video game. And so taking, you can kind of like look at population structure and like, I mean, not so much in Warcraft because the Horde is not evil, but, you know, like the good versus bad and, you know, choices people make, and you can live out a lot of things in video games that you can't do in real life. So studying all of that data is just so incredibly interesting. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that it's finally getting a little bit of traction in the academic community, to the point that it's a discipline, that there's courses, and, you know, like all of the stuff that we're doing in video games is starting to be taken more seriously, and that excites me.
Yeah. Ryan, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, using video games as an educational tool is not new. I mean, when I was in college, we did some work with Second Life where we were building, we were building a crossing guard simulation for a crossing guard the border control program in college, and they would use this simulator in Second Life to basically test their skills and learn more about how to be a border control person. And
so made papers, please.
Well,
that game's I'm glad you brought that one up. That's a really interesting example, isn't it? Game. Yeah.
It's more fun, papers, please. Yeah. This was strictly for education and was not very fun and broke a lot, as Second Life tends to do.
Sure.
But when it comes to this archaeology thing, I think it's a cool tool that that the education system can use to keep people interested. Maybe not even focus at a university or college level, but take it, you know, to high school or an elementary school to say, like, hey, kids, archaeology is cool. You don't just have to learn about science and math. You can learn about history and maybe one day want to become a GIS person or an archaeologist like this person has.
Yeah. I mean, for me, Papers, Please, it's funny you brought that up, because maybe two or three of the most difficult moral choices I've ever had to make in a modern video game happened in that game. Mm. And really hit me like over the head with like, ooh, you know, because it creates this very, I won't call it a real simulation, but a facsimile of what it might be like to be the guy who's at the booth letting people in or not letting them into your country, with horrible leadership all around the region. And some of them are good, most of them are kind of middling, and there's a few that are terrible people and you don't want them to get through. But then sometimes one of them needs to get through. He may seem terrible at first, but really he's there to be a freedom fighter. Are you willing to turn somebody away because, you know, their face looks slightly different on a card than it should, knowing that they're probably going to die if you send them back? Like, hard, hard stuff. And it'd be fun to look at that data. I don't know if that game even provides that kind of data. But, you know, Warcraft's got, you know, vaults full of data that people could study and go crazy with. So hopefully one day more of that stuff gets out.
Now, obviously, if you want to go study archaeogaming at the premier archaeogaming institutes, it's going to cost you a lot of money. Maybe one way you can do that is with a scholarship from esports. DNeil99 notes that ESPN posted to Twitter, quote, five guys from California won $6.6 million at TI5, the Super Bowl of competitive gaming. Their story this fall on E60. And E60 is a weekly hour-long news magazine show. So they're gonna throw esports right in there alongside boxing and skiing and football and everything else.
Well, the downside of their statement, and maybe this is just an unknowing social media person's thing, but to call it the Super Bowl of gaming isn't exactly correct. You could call it the Super Bowl of Dota 2, because the International is 5 is all about Dota 2, and that's it. I don't know if they had.
How do you explain? I mean, the Super Bowl is only about American football, too.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
So, I mean, I think what they're trying to say is here's a really super popular, possibly the most popular esports event.
Well, I guess, I mean, it's significant because the International made the most, had the biggest prize pool than anything else, but League of Legends matches or tournaments are technically bigger.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't know. I guess what I'm getting at is it will be interesting from here forward to see how
technically the World Cup is bigger than the Super Bowl.
Well, exactly. Exactly. See, that's my point. Like, I'm excited to watch traditional media try to wrap its head around this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I don't think it's that easy for them, but I know it's here to stay. Jocelyn, you love competitive gaming. Does this seem like the mainstream tweet we hope it is?
So I'm excited that ESPN is doing more esports content because they just had Heroes of the Dorm tournament was on ESPN. And so more mainstream exposure is good. But the five guys on the team aren't from California. No. So I'm a little bit worried about just how
California, right?
Yeah.
Is that where they're getting
the team? And the team is based out of California, but none of the players are actually from California. So it's one of those things where I hope they're not going to generalize too much. I hope they're going to explain and not make it look silly, I guess. Like, I'm just a little bit worried about how factual this
is the history of mainstream media. There could be a news article on tomorrow that would say LA man found running naked through the park more at 11, and we would all go, oh, another naked guy at the park, what was us, let's check that out at 11. But what really happened, because Tom was there and saw it, was a totally different experience. The guy had pants on and he was running with his dog, and the news mistook
it. Wasn't me.
Yeah, I wasn't going to use you. But my point is, has it ever happened to you where you've witnessed something and then heard about the thing you witnessed on the news later, and you're like, dude, they got like 5% of that right?
Well, or it'd be like saying, you know, the Oakland Raiders won the Super Bowl, which I know it's hard to imagine. And then saying, you know, 11 men from Oakland won the Super Bowl. Well, they're not all from Oakland.
Yeah,
so I guess what I'm saying is I expect a lot of them trying to grapple with the ins and outs of it. There's so much when you just hear one of those casts of one of those games, there's so much in the language of it that's, you know, people are used to hearing first and 10 and stuff from football, but they're not used to hearing that half the team went bot. We don't know why he's farming the thing up there. I mean, all these terms are just going to, they're going to take a while to leak in. So they have to figure out a way to mainstream it, and it's going to be awkward. I'm still okay with it, though, because it means that stuff takes on a bigger foothold and means we get more of it. We get better games. Like, it's a good thing overall, but you and I are going to have to suffer through it for a little while.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of RNG coverage from people who probably net deck.
See?
Tom, you win.
Yep. You win.
876 points.
A quick reminder, folks, this episode of Current Geek has been brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for simple payment solutions, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple payment types. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and more, all with one single integration. Do you want to get your first $50,000 in transactions absolutely fee-free? Easy enough. Go to BraintreePayments.com/currentgeek. Simple, secure payments you can integrate in minutes. That's BraintreePayments.com/currentgeek. On that note, that's a great note to change gears on, because it's time for you guys to sit back and enjoy the pop quiz.
America scores and wins.
All right, here's how it works. Jocelyn's done this before. Ryan, are you prepared? Are you feeling good? You all right? You all...
I'm good.
All right, that's what I like to hear. This is a chance for you guys to be asked questions in areas of her expertise. We'll start with Jocelyn because why not? She's returning, and this will also help Ryan kind of know what's coming. So, Jocelyn, you've had categories before. Today, we've decided to stick with one that you love, and that is Hearthstone trivia.
Oh, okay.
Yep. If you get an answer right, if you get it wrong, Tom scores the whole thing, and at the end...
I will make sure you follow the rules.
Yes, very closely, he says. So, here you go. I'm going to give you your first question. There are eight of them. Are you ready?
I guess.
What quote does the North Shire cleric say when you play it? I even knew this one, and I'm terrible at it.
No one plays the North Shire cleric, Scott. It's a horrible card.
It's not a good card, but...
Oh, no. Crap. I don't play priest.
Is that your final
answer?
Is
someone injured?
Oh! You got it correct.
Actually, she gets 6 points. 1 for the correct answer, 5 for not playing priest.
Man, that was amazing. All right, good job. I was sure you weren't going to get that. I had my finger hovered over the buzzer. Who is the artist for the Dr. Boom card? It's a semi-famous artist name, sort of-ish.
I never know the artists, and I should have studied because Iceworm did this to me last time, too.
Yep.
Samwise.
Yeah, you are incorrect. It is Alex Garner. Alex Garner does a lot of great
still
work.
Gets 2 bonus points for having a drink called Dr. Boom named after the show that she's on, The Angry Chicken.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They had one at the thing. That was amazing. I don't know. What they
Wait,
have
you
there?
Had a Dr. Boom?
No. I just saw them. Oh. You guys all had them. Right?
Breaking news.
Whoa.
Breaking news. Scott's drinking Dr. Booms now.
Scott's drinking again.
for the very first time. All right, how about this one? What was the first Tavern Brawl released? Or what was the first one that was released? What was it called?
Rag versus Nefarian.
You are...
Oh, no, wait.
What? Go ahead.
No, that was the first brawl, but I can't remember if that was what it was called.
Well, you were right.
Okay,
good. It's Ragnaros versus Nefarian, and it was...
Loses a half point for doubting herself, though.
Well, I guess,
hey,
I mean...
it's hard to be in this hot seat, people.
We'll give you that. I mean, technically, it's Showdown at Black Rock Mountain, but I think we give them the point. I think the points are fine there, right? Because it's still part of the name. Next up, what is the attack / durability of Ashbringer?
5-3.
You are? Oh, correct. Nice job. I want to make you sweat a little bit there.
Oh my God.
Inspiration bonus too.
I feel like I'm stacking your deck a little here by messing with you. All right, next up, how many secret cards does the mage have?
Like how many?
How many cards can you play as secrets?
Oh,
you know the
how
ones
many
they
cards
can't.
Are secrets?
Yeah.
The answer is none. You don't know. They're secret.
I feel like I'm forgetting. Oh, 6.
6. Let's find out if you're right. 7 is the correct answer.
I knew I was forgetting one.
I couldn't tell you what the 7th is, but you were very close. Third to last question. What is Edwin Van Cleef's combo ability?
4. Every card you played, gain +1/+1.
Oh, you're so close. +2/+2.
Oh, I was going to say 2, nine. And then I was like, hang on, no.
She
that's
one
wrong.
Off, so she gets 0.9.
0.9, that's good. All right, second to last question. What is the casting cost of the Eagle Horn Bow? I even knew this
3.
One. You are correct. Nicely done. I knew that one.
You can tell the classes I play and the classes I don't play.
I can tell the one class I mostly play by reading these. What spare part card gives a minion +1 attack?
Whirling Blades.
You are correct. Nicely done. Those are your questions. You didn't do too bad. That was pretty good. Yeah, take a deep breath. Everything's fine.
And the ones that I got wrong, it was totally because I was doubting myself.
Well, there you go. We've learned something together today.
Yeah.
Ryan, it's your turn. How are you feeling? You good?
Well, I'm good. I would have got 0 on all those questions.
All right.
That's why they weren't asked to you.
Well, that's why I'm glad. I'm feeling a lot better now.
Then let's see how you do with zombie movie trivia.
Yeah. Oh, God.
all right. Here you go, man. What are the zombies in the Evil Dead movies known as?
Oh, The Deadites?
Oh my, you totally got it.
Oh, okay.
That's exactly it, the Deadites. Nicely done. See, don't doubt yourself.
1 point surprise bonus for being surprised at getting the answer right.
Go with your gut. All right. What is the name of the real world mall used in the filming of the original Dawn of the Dead film?
The Escalator Ferry. I don't know.
The Escalator Ferry. Monroeville.
There's escalators in it.
It's the Monroeville Mall is the correct
answer. You almost made me spit water out my nose.
That was the goal.
Well, 5 point most creative wrong answer, and then half point spitting out nose Jocelyn.
Yeah,
bonus.
And if I was given points, it'd be a full point for coming up with the funniest name for a mall ever. The Escalator Ferry Mall.
No, that's the 5 point bonus right there. Scott. Yeah, absolutely. Oh,
all right. Here you go.
It's if you've read the rules,
and it's almost like I have the book right here. What is the title of the first episode of the first season of The Walking Dead television series?
Alone?
You are incorrect. It is Days Gone By.
Is that what it said? Pilot?
Pilot?
Ah, dang.
Thing,
that would have been good.
Thing based on a comic? Okay, next up. What year was the original Night of the Living Dead released? I will give you one hint. It was before Tom or I were born.
Whoa, that's old. Oh,
I feel if I get this wrong or right, I'd be in trouble. 1978?
You? Oh, man.
You flatterer. Yeah, 100 points.
100 points for that guy.
Thank you.
The correct answer is in 1968. 1968. Oh. Tom and I were born in 69. We're old. Next up, who directed the 2002 film 28 Days Later? Not weeks, days. That's an important distinction.
Danny Boyle?
You are correct. Nicely done. I'm a huge fan of both, but I really like... I know I'm usually alone in this, but I think Weeks is a better film.
It's also the name of the particular sore that a zombie gets on its cheek, the
Ooh.
Danny Boyle.
Oh, the Danny Boyle. Ooh, you don't want the Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
Lance that Danny Boyle.
Gets everywhere when it explodes.
They call that the Lance Hendrickson.
Yeah.
What character does Brad Pitt play in World War Z?
Not a character from the book?
Well, that is correct. However, the name is Jerry Lane.
No, I still think he gets a point. That is true.
Yeah. I was among the many that was disappointed that the book was just happening in the war that the movie was taking place in the setting of the book, but not part of the book. But then I saw it and I kind of liked it. So I kind of turned a corner on that. I thought it was pretty good. In what year did Greg Nicotero and Robert Kurtzman and Howard Berger join the KNB EFX group?
Whoa. What? Ice forms.
Yeah.
Wait, what year?
Yeah, what year? This is a who the hell knows this?
It's a proof of worth question here.
Yeah.
2000 and what year is it now? 2008.
You're only close because there was an 8 in it. It's 1988.
Oh.
88.
Oh, crazy eights.
Yeah.
You actually lose 8 points for that.
That's fine.
20 years after Night of the Living Dead. All right. Next up, what actor's earlobes had their own dressing room for The Walking Dead? He is so... This isn't even a real question, Ice Worm.
No, I know this. He's playing the Punisher. I only know him as his earlobes, though, so...
Right. He has to have 3 SAG cards, I always used to joke.
Sean something, which probably isn't right.
Well, let's find out if you're right. Hold on. He didn't put... Oh, yeah, no, he didn't. It's John Bernthal. He played Shane on The Walking Dead.
Mm.
So there you go.
Oh,
have it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and he is going to be... He is the Punisher in the second season of the Daredevil there.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And the old Daredevil.
Yeah, the old Daredevil. So there you go. Both of you did just fine, I think, but I can't really tell until Tom does his math. So, Tom, how'd they do?
Wow, both, you're right. Both did fantastic. Jocelyn with a stellar 12.9 points. But Ryan finishing with 101.5.
Yeah.
Flattery gets you everything.
Was it all BMs?
I call shenanigans.
You can call whoever you want. Them's the rules.
We don't have a call a friend feature in this show, sadly. But we do have something called Forecast.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
All right, we're going to do a thing that used to be a show now. It's a segment. It's called Forecasts, where we try to predict the future. Tom has one today. Tom, what do you see in your crystal ball?
All right, so virtual worlds, kind of what we were talking about earlier with the Archaeo gaming story, not just World of Warcraft, but what's the sky one?
Oh, Skyrim.
No, not Skyrim. Never-ending sky, unending sky.
The No Man's Sky.
No Man's Sky, thank you. Mm. And then VR, virtual reality, which will probably spawn more worlds that we will live in. Eventually, someday, those worlds will be accepted more by the mainstream populace than things like theme parks are today. People will do practical things in them. Some they will create jobs. Whole economies will exist that are real economies, not just in-game economies. And it will be, you know, some people go to work in virtual worlds.
So okay. Basically, you're describing. I mean, it's easy to go to Ready Player One and some of its concepts. For me anyway, when I think about these sort of things, but that's basically kind of what you're describing. We'll be able to build worlds that are either as compelling enough or as immersive enough, and maybe VR ushers this in.
To me, it's not even just that. It's the social aspect of it, right? So where I would differ from the Ready Player One universe is some of this won't be gaming related. Mm. You'll just go and you'll have a job. Maybe it'll be sort of an accounting job or working on data mining with a virtual pickaxe. No, I'm just kidding. Whereas Ready Player One was entirely a gaming world, there will be virtual worlds that are just like, oh yeah, that's the business park.
Oh, okay.
Virtual
thing. So kind of like in that book, they had the school world, which I thought was interesting, where people could go to school. So sort of like that. So okay, every time you describe Bitcoin to me, it makes me think, wouldn't that be a cool? Because that's already kind of a virtual, quote unquote, mining.
It is virtual. Yeah.
Exactly. So why couldn't I go to some Tron cubicle in cyberspace and sit there and mine Bitcoins in an environment where I had directional audio, people could talk to me, we could meet up in the conference room and give Linda from accounting her cake because it's her birthday. Like, all that stuff could happen.
And I don't think it'll necessarily be mimicking the real world. It'll just be things that you're like, oh, the VR interface makes it much easier for me to do this kind of thing that's not entertainment related in a virtual space.
Interesting.
It's like aircraft part design, and you're an aircraft part designer and you go to work by putting on the helmet and meeting up with other designers and sitting there and twirling things around and making parts.
Yeah.
I
think that stuff sooner than later. I agree with you 100%. Jocelyn, what do you think about being able to collaborate in that way?
It could be really, really interesting. And I think the more that we see kind of VR come to life, then the sooner we're going to see this, it's going to make collaborating so much easier, because I know, like, I, for one, hate conference calls. You can't see people. People are talking over each other all the time. I think if there's a way that you can actually be in the same space without being in the same space, it's a lot of companies are going to adopt that very, very quickly. Even I would say, you know, Skype isn't quite the same. It's hard. Sometimes there's lag, there's visual cues that we miss. And, you know, if we can actually be all sitting around the same table, it's going to make collaborating a whole lot easier.
So
even if it is virtual.
So Ryan, like, okay, so I was just going to use that. I'm glad you brought it up, because here's this example of a thing that could have been somebody's forecast 50 years ago, 60 years ago or something, where they're like sitting around trying to figure out how we're going to communicate in the future. And someone may have in their imagination imagined Captain Kirk style communication devices that were screens, and somebody's face would show up there and we could talk to them no matter where they were in the ship or around the world, that we would have portable devices that could support that same technology. I could see their face speaking to me. The way that, you know, Paul Reiser talked to Ripley in Aliens and, you know, woke her up or whatever, how that worked out in that movie. Those things seemed far off, crazy ideas, never going to happen in our lifetime. Yet here we are very easily, without thinking about it too much, all set up doing that tonight with each other. So we've kind of, despite the lag and the visual cues and all of the stuff you talked about, we're still in a place that you couldn't even have imagined 50, 60 years ago. I think we're going to be to this place Tom's talking about in less time. I think in 4 or 5 years, we're there. They're already showing some of this stuff off. They're showing the kind of presence you need to be able to hear, see, interact with people. Facial recognition is only going to get better, which means more translation of what your expressions are being represented in the real world. And, you know, we're heading down that path. Do you agree, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, with technology that we have now with Skype, was something that is now widely available, was available for businesses that were willing to spend tens of thousands of dollars on these systems to have video conferencing just at work. And I think as this technology progresses, it's really going to require businesses to become okay with using it for, say, allowing more folks to work from home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that seems to be what's going on right now, is a work from home program at every one of these businesses that pop up. And it's becoming more and more natural to let your employees, you know, log in from home, do their job from their home office. And I think with these virtual worlds, it really allows people to work from home, but still be in an environment that keeps them productive, keeps them motivated to do their job, you know, as opposed to being in a cubicle farm. They can be in a virtual, well, cubicle. You wouldn't want to be in a virtual cubicle farm. You know,
they're in a virtual cubicle farm playing their virtual cubicle farm game.
Yeah.
Right. On your virtual iPad.
Virtual cubicle farm.
Yeah. You mean cubicle farmer on iOS. I know the one.
Yeah.
It's the hit new World freemium. Of Warcraft inside World of Warcraft.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh, the snake is eating itself.
No, I actually, I mean, these are all great examples, but I mean something well beyond this, where your work is virtual and it's mm-hmm. in a virtual world, and you are making something that is virtual and is of value to other people and is shipped to them. Or maybe it's got real world implications, but it's practical to do it entirely in virtual. So we're not just talking about a conference call. I'm not just talking about, oh, well, we'll have a better monitor or a better way of looking at things. Like, I'm saying Archeo Gaming points to the future where we will be studying, working, and living inside some people inside virtual reality, because that's where part of reality will have invaded.
Mm, yeah. Like maybe building hats for TF2, like that's all done in a digital world. I mean,
that's the digitally only modern sewing example.
Right.
Right. I can't get my, this is the future. Sorry. I've got to take my brain out.
You got to wear a virtual future hat. I would like to add to this, and this popped into my head. The other day I was watching a replay, and this technology has been around forever in other games, but Heroes of the Storm has a replay feature, so you can have a game, and then a very small data file is kept of your previous game. And that data file basically has all the math and code to recreate an exact replica of the game you just played in real time with all the polygons. It's not video of what happened. It's data that the game can translate and run in the engine, okay, as if people were playing it right then. That's always been fascinating to me, that you can even do that, period. But what really fascinates me about that is the idea of, let's imagine a podcast roundtable. We're all supposed to be in the same room talking in real time on real nice mics, all sitting around a table with each other or standing in a room talking to each other. The future of podcasting is that happens. It's me, it's Tom, it's Joss, it's Ryan. We're having this conversation. And when it's done, people aren't just downloading the audio. People may still, because they'll go run their round the track and they want to have something while they exercise. Fine, whatever. They'll still be that. But there could just be this small data file, a little vector file that's got all the data of the geometry of the show, meaning our bodies, the table, extra chairs, whatever environment we created in there. And all they got to do is put on their little headsets, hit play. That data recreates all of the geometry, all of the math, and boom, they can walk around in there, see it from any angle they want to. They can poke Tom in the eye. They can do whatever they want.
They always do. I hate that.
That, to me, I'm telling you that it doesn't, that sounds futuristic, but I'm telling you, I think we're almost freaking there. Like, I'll bet that's a thing you can do. I'll tack onto your prediction and say in 5 years, we're doing that. It may not be super high fidelity. It may not be exactly what we're needing. Maybe we don't even have a use for it. I'm just saying, one day, whatever you and I do in a virtual space can then be replayed by somebody else with the data of it happening alone, and you can interact in it. And it's just about as close as we're going to get to holodecks, I'm telling you.
Oh, I think there'll be things in there that are, there's a, you know, virtual esport that is entirely popular and causes trouble for the people who play it. In some data manifest way, it causes issues with their computer, and there will be a whole industry of people to help repair those people's ability to do things that they want to do in the computer world, and it will all happen virtually, and you'll go in and you'll fix things. And I think Bitcoin is probably the closest to what I'm thinking of, Scott, where we will create things that exist entirely in outside of physical manifestation that people will be able to inhabit virtually. And it's not just a new faster computer and a cooler interface. It's an entire leap forward. The way that, you know, existing in an MMORPG like World of Warcraft is an entirely different existence, albeit a real one, mm-hmm. a human one. Mm-hmm.
So maybe you're really good at building structures polygonally for people's homes, and it's not based on, well, now anyone can do it because it's a computer. It's based on you have a special eye for it, a talent for it, just like, you know, you had Michelangelo do your freaking ceiling because he was, you know, that's what he did. He was amazing at it. Everybody can grab a can of paint and a brush, but only he could do what he did, right? So maybe only Tom could make the big virtual cathedrals everybody wants. Like actual structural stuff in virtual space. That's really interesting to me. If you could only build it there and make a living, Bitcoin's just transferring to your account as you make these people's houses. Oh, Tom, I like what you've done today. You've got my brain going. Thank you for that.
And I'm also, like, Ian and I are having a great conversation in the chat room while I'm trying to do this too, which is actually entirely the example of what I'm talking about. Oh, I'm having a virtual conversation.
Yeah, it's happening. It's just not happening with it's that's my point. We're all doing this stuff already.
Yeah.
We're just at the next step. Like, I'm already creating. Oh my gosh. Here, I want to blow everyone's mind for a second. I have a Wacom tablet right over here. I haven't drawn on paper for work in almost a decade now. I go over to this thing, and in whatever time it takes me, I create something from nothing digitally with a pen to a screen interface. There's zero material involved other than the interface. I build that thing, I color it, I make, give it depth, I give it personality, I do it, all these things. I know what I need to do, and I send that thing out, and it's suddenly everyone's wallpaper, and they could have paid for it to get it. And my point is, I just did the thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
We're just talking about a completely not enclosed, but being in the space and making the thing in the space. That's just, we're just a few steps from it, man. We're almost there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is my point, is there are things that we can't imagine will be done yet. So it's impossible to give the right examples because the situation hasn't been created for people. The way that Bitcoin, if you in 1990 had been trying to predict Bitcoin, you wouldn't have come close to the mark.
Yeah.
Because cryptography and networking and the math behind it just hadn't been invented yet. So you could say, we'll have a virtual currency, but you'd mean something like flus. You wouldn't mean something like Bitcoin.
Yeah, good point. Well, that's maybe one of my favorite forecasts we've ever done. It could be the orange juice I'm drinking. I don't know. Could be that. All right. We got a quick, we get feedback here on the show. Currentgeek@gmail.com. You can send your emails there. And I got one, a quick one from Shauna, who says, quick, the best kids movie ever made. Go, go, go. That's not the name of a kids movie. That's just them saying hurry up. I'm going to just put it to our guests first. So Ryan, let's start with you. Do you have, if you had to pick out of the sky, the best kids movie you saw? And I think what they're getting at here is like, what movie did you see as a kid that was the most sort of impactful or something? And what would you say?
I don't know. That's tough. Like, as a movie I saw as a kid, I can't really think of one, but I'm going to cheat and go like more recent. I mean, the Lego movie was a movie that I watched and I said, wow, this is a movie that I could probably sit down and watch with my kids in 2 or 3 years when they're able to understand, oh, Lego moving around on screen. And it works for me too, because it's funny and it's got moments and it's kid friendly. And I grew up with Lego. So yeah, I mean, I can't really even think of a movie from when I was a kid that I would say is the best kids movie, but I think the Lego movie is probably the best one I can name right now.
That's a perfect fit. Joss, what would you say?
The first thing that came into my head was Ferngully. I freaking love that movie.
Great movie.
Wow.
It's the kind of thing that I watched, I don't even know how many times when I was a kid, you know, like, I want to watch it again, Mom. Like, Batty's so great. Best movie character ever.
Yeah.
It's got the whole environmentalist kind of vibe to it, and it's entertaining. Oh, yeah, definitely Ferngully, 100%.
All right, Tom, do you got one? I mean, we could cheat and say Star Wars because we were 7. Yeah,
well, see, that's the thing. When I think personally, like, what was my favorite movie as a kid?
Yeah.
I think Herbie The Love Bug.
Oh, amazing.
I love those movies.
Amazing.
But Captain Kipper said Star Wars in the chat. And I think of it as an adult movie, but man, I was 7 years old when I saw it for the first time and I adored it.
Yeah.
And it is in some ways a kid's movie, right? Yeah. So
it informs so much of who I've become and most of my friends have become. Like Star Wars, you can't deny its impact, but if we're talking just kid fare, so I'll cheat a little bit and go to when I was in junior high, because for whatever reason, it hit at the right time and was the right subject. And just felt like a coming-of-age movie, even though people think I'm crazy when I say this. But for whatever reason, Time Bandits by Terry Gilliam, which is super weird. It's about a time-traveling kid with a bunch of little people, dwarves. And they meet Robin Hood, and they meet Napoleon. They meet, I almost said Napoleon Dynamite. That didn't happen.
They need Napoleon Dynamite. It's such a weird prediction.
There's this weird devil played by David Warner, who's amazing. It is one of the strangest good versus evil tales. And I think what it was is it was like a kid's movie about a kid growing up, but it was also super dark and weird. And it best represented my transition, starting to get into adolescence, hitting puberty, feeling awkward, feeling like a complete dork. Not feeling like the jock in school. For whatever reason, this spoke to me on all those levels and just felt like a transition film for me. And I still, to this day, I can't watch it without bringing back all the emotions you have when you're, you know, entering seventh, eighth grade or whatever it was, and trying to find your place and your voice and have people like you and all of that. And there's something about Time Bandits that gets me every time. So if you guys haven't seen Time Bandits, totally recommend it. But I don't exactly expect you to have the same experience I did, because it's so much of it was informed about where I was at the time. And in some ways, Star Wars was that way, too. It was like perfect.
Well, I didn't watch Time Bandits until I was much older. So mm-hmm. I always think about it as something I discovered when I was, you know, in my 20s.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, we did it for Film Sack not long ago, and it was Randy's first viewing. And he was like, I don't see what the big deal is here.
Right, right.
And I was like, it is one of the biggest deals. So it was a lesson in, you know, like there were adults at the time Star Wars came out that probably thought it was pretty neat, but they weren't like us, you know, because we were seven.
Yeah.
It was the greatest thing ever made. And, you know, but they're probably like 35-year-old guys going, all right.
And every birthday and Christmas I experienced for until the late 80s,
yeah.
I got something related to Star Wars every time.
Yeah. Me for years. I still, and the irony is I still get Star Wars related stuff now. For gifts.
Yeah, me too.
I would throw a runner-up in there and just say Bugsy Malone. It was the one with all the kids. Scott Baio was just a kid in it. Michael Jackson's in it. No one's ever heard of this, but it's basically a bunch of kids that are like mobsters, but they're kids. And it plays like a mobster movie. It's also a musical, but they shoot each other with machine guns full of whipped cream. Have you seen this? It's amazing.
See, I keep thinking of 70s movies because that's when I was in my single digits as a kid's movie. But you're naming movies I think of as more teen movies.
Well, Bugsy Malone came out. Let's just look real quick. Bugsy Malone.
I'm thinking like Apple Dumpling Gang and Disney's Robin Hood.
Well, see, this is pretty
Disney's
old.
Disney's Robin Hood was another really that's, good one.
Yeah, so that
good,
was pretty yeah. impactful for sure. It was 1976, Bugsy Malone. So it's still in the 70s.
Okay. All right. I was thinking it was later than that.
I was like 6, 7 years old. Directed by Alan Parker, Jodie Foster, Scott Baio. Like these were all kids, though. And it's straight up like watching The Cotton Club or some kind of old mobster yeah. movie set in the 20s and the speakeasies and all that stuff. But the guns and the things they would fight with each other were pies and whipped cream in the guns. It's fantastic. I mean, it's probably yeah. terrible, but I'm just telling you, it's great. So go see.
I think we should also mention Pixar movies because all of them are just amazing.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, Jocelyn, how old were you in 95 when the first Toy Story came out?
11.
Oh, my Lord. But see, that totally works. Like
it was pretty perfect.
I was like 23 or 4 or something, but that was overwhelmingly obvious that movies are about to change. Animation was about to change. Like we were entering a new era. And yeah, you can't deny the power of that thing. So yeah, for sure.
I'm kind of regretting now. I wish I would have pretended like Rashomon was my favorite kid movie. Something really pretentious.
Great. That'd be perfect.
I only watched Kurosawa films yeah. as a young man.
Yeah, of course. Seven Samurai, you know.
Young man.
all right. Well, there you go. Again, feedback, currentgeek@gmail.com is the address, currentgeek@gmail.com. Before we go, I wanted to quickly make a mention about the ongoing, although near ending, and I want people to know about it if they haven't heard about it. Todd Whitehead over there at Alpha Geek Media, he runs Alpha Geek Radio, Alpha Geek Video. If you've listened to the show live before off of one of our Twitter links, chances are it's off of his live stream that he provides for us, this amazing service to people like Tom and I. And Gamers Inn's on there as well. Like, everybody loves Todd, and Todd does amazing work for everybody. So he's running an Indiegogo right now. Go over to Indiegogo.com, search for Alpha Geek Media, and consider supporting it. Throw a little cash his way. He's just trying to expand servers, add new features and services. And we wanted to make sure to let him know, A, how much we appreciate him, but also, B, it's your chance to see that grow. So go help him out, won't you? I guess that's it. You guys were amazing. What great guests. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jocelyn, tell people where they can find Jocelyn Moffat on the internet.
Best place to find me is over on Twitter. I'm at GIS Gamer. Everything that I do in terms of all my shows are over on amove.tv. And if you want to watch me streaming, I stream 5 nights a week on twitch.tv/GIS Gamer.
Jeez, 5 nights a week now. That's amazing.
5 nights a week.
Sheesh. That's the new, it's the hot new horror game. 5 nights a week at Freddy's.
Oh man, I tried that. I made it through about 40 minutes. It was the most terrifying thing I've ever done.
No, I can't do horror games. Yeah.
Oh man. I can't do it either. Bad.
I'm with you. I can't do it. I'm the worst. That's why I couldn't do more than one part of that whatever that thing was where you break into the asylum. I couldn't do it. Oh,
Outlast?
Outlast.
Yeah, I screamed like a 5-year-old. It was terrible.
Yeah. Did you stream it though? Because I streamed it.
Streamed it and recorded it. And it's out there for the world to see, but I'm done. Part one was it. That's all. $20 for one part. So that's all you get. Ryan, where can people find you?
You can find all my stuff at ryanmurphy.ca. Follow me on Twitter at rmurphy. Obviously, The Gamer's Inn. You can listen to Zombies Ate My Podcast if you don't want to know about zombie movies, because I don't know much about them except for flattery. And then there's also Sleeping with the Elephant that I record with Paul, where I talk about Canadian stuff and he talks about American stuff.
Oh, nice. Never the twain shall meet.
No. Well, sometimes. Once in a while.
Occasionally. Well, you're two fine Canadians and you represent your country well.
Thank you.
Tom Merritt, anything else before we go?
Want to thank everybody. I've been plugging Citadel 32, my book, every week, it seems like, all over the place. And I've been getting so much good feedback from folks on Twitter and in the Amazon reviews and everything. So just wanted to say thanks.
Yeah.
You guys making my week, making my year.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
People digging that book. Who knows what the next NaNoWriMo will produce out of Tom. It'll be something else, though. I can tell you that. That's going to do it. I am hard at work on the Extra Life book, the Kickstarter funded last month, and couldn't be happier about that. Thank you, everybody who supported it. Work is ongoing, trying to make it real special and awesome. Hope to have some updates and some videos out soon, so watch for that. Follow Tom at Ace Detect. Follow me at Scott Johnson on Twitter. The show is at Current Geek. Oh my, what else? CurrentGeek.com is our website. CurrentGeek.reddit.com is our subreddit. I think it's going to do it for us. Until next time. Oh, we're not here next week. Tom's out of town. But the week after that, we are.
My fault.
For me, for Tom, and for our guests. We'll see you next time.